All right. Thanks, Eileen. Thanks, everyone, for being here. This is a great honor for me to both attend the conference and present my work here. It's been a bit overwhelming for me trying to absorb everything that's been said and discussed here, and it's been a tremendous learning experience. I am in the Department of Computer Science at Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and my group is primarily working in bioinformatics, and in particular on regulatory genomics. And this talk will be about some work we've been doing in the last couple of years on cis regulatory modules or enhancers in Drosophila. So given the content of the talks in this week, I don't think I need to explain what I'm talking about here. So here's an example of a gene expression pattern from the Drosophila embryo, and an example of the expression pattern driven by a particular cis regulatory module. And it's been all very well studied, and people have shown that these modules or enhancers have clusters of binding sites for multiple transcription factors that act together to drive the expression pattern or a part of the expression pattern of the of a gene somewhere around it. What we do in our group is develop computational tools for discovering novel enhancers, and this is what I did as a postdoc in Eric Sigge's lab at the Rockefeller University. We developed a variety of tools that that use motifs and comparative genomics to find novel enhancers. And over the last couple of years, we've been getting more into developing tools that enable people to understand the function and evolution of those enhancers. So I won't be talking about the discovery part much at all, except put up one slide as an advertisement for a web server that we have called the Drosophila Genome Surveyor, where you can, in a genome browser interface, you can examine motif content along the genome for each of over 300 transcription factors, and do various things with them, combine various subsets of motifs to look for enhancers using that. This tool is, you can use this tool on, through the web server, so it's real time, and hopefully useful for you. If you want more details on that, please talk to me after the talk. So that's all about the discovery part. As I said, more recently, we've started looking at tools for understanding the function and evolution of these cis regulatory modules. And I'll begin with the first aspect. So what I mean here is to build tools that will predict the expression driven by a cis regulatory module given the sequence. And of course, in the first cut, we'll be using not just the sequence, but also other information about the inputs coming into the enhancer. And in particular, in the context of the anterior-posterior patterning in the embryo, this is the kind of inputs we would expect. That these are the concentration profiles of various transcription factors along the axis of the embryo on a one-dimensional axis. And what we're trying to develop is something that will take that information and the sequence information and predict this kind of function for the sequence. And actually, we'll simplify that that function as being a pattern in one dimension along the axis. And so if this, let's say this is the real expression pattern in one dimension, we'd like to be able to predict that. Describe here. We've built some tools that do some simple motif counting and try to combine them through linear or logistic regression models, but I'm not getting into that here. Here, the particular approach I'm going to describe is a family of approaches based on statistical thermodynamics, which goes back in my limited knowledge, to something that she to this paper from 1985, and then was further explained and elaborated in work from Terry Hua's lab, more recently used to understand or model regulatory function of promoters in yeast by Eric Tsiji and Barak Cohen. So these are various previous publications that have presented the ideas, the basic theoretical framework for allowing us to do something like what I described earlier, to predict function from expression. These were all tried out in the context of modeling promoter activity. And in fact, all of them are very similar in design, and this is the kind of model that our framework, the computational framework I'll describe, will be based on. There's also a variety of other approaches, other quantitative models for the same task, work from John Reinitz's group and from Papatsenko and Levine. Has proposed alternative approaches for the same task of quantitative modeling of expression, and these were actually in the context of enhancers and Drosophila, so not just promoters. Despite the existence of all these theoretical ideas and their applications to specific genes or enhancers, a general purpose software implementation had been missing, so there was nothing that would allow you to take a bunch of data on the expression driven by a number of enhancers and just fit the model and be able to use it to predict expression of any arbitrary piece of sequence. And so that was one of the motivations for this project. And I'll describe the underlying model for the for our implementation for doing this. So let's imagine that there are three binding sites in an enhancer, and let's imagine that the one in the middle is a site for a repressor, and the two sites on the sides are for the same activator. Now you can you have these activator and repressor molecules in the nucleus, and they play a sort of a game of musical chairs, coming and sitting on their respective sites, and then going off depending on how much the concentration is and how strong the affinity for the site is. And so you can, given that there are three sites, you can imagine 8 possible configurations of these sites being occupied by their respective transcription factors. So the green is the activator transcription factor, and the red is the repressor in this case. Now you can quantify or represent the binding affinity of the site for its factor through a statistical weight that depends on the site itself, the actual sequence of the site, and the concentration of this green molecule. And it's the standard way to do that. And in fact, in this quantification, you can use the PWM or motif of the transcription factor, in particular, the log likelihood ratio of the site for that motif is some sort of a pseudo-energy term that you can plug into to capture the relationship between the site sequence and the binding energy. And then you can assign a statistical weight to each configuration by simply multiplying the statistical weights of the individual sites, and this corresponds to a simple adding of the energy terms, these two energy interactions, interaction energies, and that corresponds to a multiplication of the statistical weights. And finally, the main point is that the statistical weight is the relative probability of the configuration. So if you were to take a snapshot of the system, the probability, and at a random point of time, the probability that you'll see one of these configurations is given by the statistical weight. And so this is a standard, one standard way to approach this kind of a problem, and often called fractional occupancy models of these binding sites and enhancers. And so what I've described is a way to look at the configurations of bound and non-bound states of these sites, and how to quantify the probability or fractional occupancy of any given site. Yes. So that's been done 20 or 30 years ago. I know a paper from Gary Stormo, but I'm not sure if it was done before that as well. Do any of you guys remember when it was first done? Bill?
So there's two parts to the question, right? One is, can you measure binding energy? What do we know about binding energy measured directly? And for example, can they be described by linear models at a time? So there's a modern literature on this, for example, people like the Plate Group and others who try to do this directly measuring binding energy. And the answer, as you might expect, is linear models are pretty good, but not perfect. There's an older literature, and actually was read last paper, right? If you go back to Berg and von Hippel, who were the first people to try to do it, they actually used it for the RNA polymerase binding primer in the motors of bacteria. They were able to show that if you look at the frequency of occurrence of the bases and do the standard single thing, and then compare that with direct in vitro diagnostic measurements, it's not bad. Even then. There were only 100 sequences available.
This is like the early 80s or so.
So there is history, but it's not this graph, right? So there was this period in which people actually did that kind of research. And then somehow that went out of fashion, and now you have lots of type of quick things, but there are some. Then there's another question. Right. So there's different. One question is, can you measure the energy? Yeah. Next question is, are they related to the statistical things that you get by lining up sequences? And the last one is, how do these, are these things interacting with each other? How are they interacting with the initiation of the
I think one of the
questions
is
whether
a lot of these, things
that
you talked about, the late 80s, but even the next two quakers had as well. In vitro and artificial, like a second naked DNA, and putting large amounts of purified protein in contact with this naked DNA, and then saying, okay, what kind of binding affinities can I calculate then? Because that's not the way things work in vivo. So it's just a word of caution.
I think we're still, I haven't seen any data where you say, given the binding energies that I predict for synthesizing this region, can I now in vivo show that the occupancy of the protein on these sites is actually reasonably predicted by those numbers?
Well, what you'd really like to do, of course, is to show that the expression levels of the genes are related.
Well, another step.
But actually, that's the part.
What I'm going to try to do.
But imagine that directly. So, there are these things that one of the that direction, right? I mean, they have their own difficulties, but where you actually try to predict expression levels from these models, I haven't done a wide range of unit tests, but it works very well, but not perfectly. But again, but those are the simples, right? Those are the bacterial systems.
I'm very interested. I would be interested in a session where we could look at the physics field and say, maybe say what is done with the session.
I won't be going into the physics-based questions because I don't understand the physics much at all. What I will be going into is the sort of the bioinformatics, the computational and statistical aspects. So the goal here is, you know, you have data on expression and on the one hand, and you have these ideas, the models and ideas already existing. And you'll see that I won't come up with any new models or any new ideas, just whatever has been in the literature. And then the goal is to bridge the gap by building tools that can, you know, that can handle a large number of enhancers, large amount of data, and try to fit and see how well this idea does. For example, this is a fairly simple idea that I'm going to present. How well does it do? And then, do we need to add other aspects to the model? And whether, given the data, given the noisiness of the data, does it help to add any other mechanistic aspects or make the model more fancy in any ways? And that's why I'm really interested in talking to you guys, because you guys are really both the endpoints of what I what we work on. You guys generate the data and try to and have the biological questions, and you guys also come up with the ideas and models, the theoretical ideas that need to explain. Oh yeah. In fact, an enhancer will have several, even up to 7 or 8 binding sites with the same activator. And that seems to be the general, at least in this early development enhancers, the more of the rule than the exception. Which is why. So I'll come to that in the next slide. Yes.
I fully agree with the way you do it, but maybe for us to keep in mind that the model, in addition to assuming that the contributions add up, which would kind of be the physical explanation, it also implies independent finding, even from a purely statistical model.
Right, exactly. Exactly. As I've presented it and I said it, you're adding up the energy terms. And if you don't like that, you can modify the tool, and that's what, and it's not at all hard to do. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. S is a site, the particular site you're looking at, and the weight of the site is related to the transcription factor concentration, which you know to a relative level. You don't know the absolute values. It's related to the energy of the site relative to the energy of the optimal site, and the K for the optimal site, and there's a scale, and there's a free parameter to scale the concentration, which is known only relatively. Yes.
It's a technical question, but it sort of implies, I guess, that you have somewhere some cutoff that says anything that scores for your rate matrix above this score is going to be a site, and I'm going to look at all possible ways of...
Correct, that's correct. So
you're not going to do some full partition sum overall.
Well, so the program, the implementation does not need a cutoff, because you can imagine placing these boxes in any arbitrary place, and it sums over everything. But in practice, we run it by defining a site where the motif matches better than background, which is like the incredibly weak cutoff. But you understand that you don't need any cutoff for this is just a way to, if you've placed the sites here, if you imagine these are the sites which are occupied, this is how you'd go about it. But you don't need to, you can have these boxes entirely overlaid everywhere. And the program's built that way. All right, so yes, so Bill was talking, saying, mentioning that we I need to describe how we go from these musical chair snapshots to the gene expression level. And again, here, this is the simplest model that I found in the literature. Also, Shea and Acker's, this was built for promoters. And it's the following. So imagine that there's also the basal transcriptional machinery, which has to sit on the promoter. This is not supposed to be continuous. You're imagining this thing looping over and contacting the BTM. But there's this BTM or basal transcriptional machinery, which may be occupying the promoter or not. So there's two versions of each of the original configurations, and half of them have the BTM bound. And the model is that the gene expression level or mRNA level observed is proportional to the probability of these states together. So the relative probability of the BTM being occupied at the promoter is what gives the gene expression level modulo. So no pausing or anything considered here. Right, absolutely, yes. No. So it's a conceptual, absolutely conceptual, yes, yes. Correct. You don't need this. It's conceptual. And I'll explain that in the next slides where I show, by the way, again, this is the Shea and Acker's approach. This is how activators and repressors are modeled as acting. Okay. You can imagine that this BTM is sitting here and an activator interacts with the BTM. And this interaction energy is some alpha A, which is a favorable energy term for an activator, and that the repressor also interacts, and this is an unfavorable energy term for a repressor. So basically, an activator stabilizes the configuration, the repressor destabilizes the configuration in this manner. That's the model. And as Alex pointed out, you didn't need to think of it in this way, that the BTM is sitting there. It's just you have to have some way to model the actual effect of the bound activator molecule on gene expression, and this is one. This is the conceptual way to do that. Okay. So now, again, the statistical weight of a configuration like that would be obtained by multiplying this and this and this and this and this and this, which corresponds to adding up all of these interaction terms. Which is saying that everything is, all these effects are independent. And so again, this is the starting model. All right, so I've described the basic model, and now the implementation, remember, has to compute the probability of these configurations relative to these configurations to predict a gene expression value. And therefore, it has to enumerate all of these configurations, compute the weight of all of them. And typically, an enhancer would have, 10, 15, 20 sites if you are looking at a weak threshold, even more, 30 sites. And that becomes a task of enumerating 2 to the 30 or two different configurations and doing these calculations. And so this, you know, that's why there's some implementation issues there. But before that, let's go back to examining the model. There are two free parameters for per transcription factor. One is representing the TF-DNA interaction, the other for the TF's effect on gene expression, activation for activators and repression for repressors. And this is generally the case for most of the models that, you know, that I mentioned earlier, the quantitative models. There'll be two parameters per transcription factor at the very least, to, you know, because those models will try to separately keep the protein DNA and protein BDM interactions separate from each other. And so the task of the implementation is that, given these parameters, the relative TF concentration values and any sequence, compute the predicted expression level, which is the fractional occupancy of the BDM. And the implementation can do that in time proportional to the length of the sequence. So, yes?
So, I don't really understand why you need two free parameters. I mean, one of them we can estimate because we know something about the sequence and the binding. The other one we know almost nothing about.
Right. Wait. So, so you said, you said this is something we know nothing about, right?
Very, very little.
This one. So yeah. So clearly, this has to be a free parameter here. This one, the binding of the, this represents the binding of the protein to the site, and remember that it depends on the transcription factor concentration, and the sequence of the site through the motif. Now, firstly, the concentration is known in relative terms. So you need a scaling constant, which is unknown. In fact, you also need the association constant for the optimal site, because the motif really gives you an estimate of binding energies up to a constant. You know, it won't. So there's another parameter there. And happily, those two parameters can be treated as one here, because they cannot be decoupled in the way we are modeling. So there are two actual unknowns here, the scaling constant and the strength of the optimal site. Neither, you know, but that can be represented by one parameter. And so we do need a parameter for this. Which will then scale the effect of the motif score on the site, and we certainly need a parameter for that.
Why is the one greater than one and the
other? Oh, this is just saying that this, because this is an activator, and because you'll be multiplying this, you know, it's e to the minus energy, so you'll be the greater than one means it'll stabilize, it'll make increase the probability of
the one is
a destabilizer, it's repressor. Yes, Alex.
How is the calculation of all possible arrangements different from the sum of all PWM scores along all positions?
Right. Right. I think if all sites were, I'd prefer to answer that later. I'd have to think a little. If all sites were non-overlapping, you're right. You can do the sum and then multiply. But the implementation allows for overlapping sites as well, which is, happens to be the case. Be the reality or the proposed reality in some cases. So, in which case you cannot do that.
Scores or energies, and you just sum them all up, and you've got one configuration that you described, in which for every like, for example, that will give you the energy of fully occupied.
No, his question is, you know, when writing the program to enumerate all of these configurations and sum up the probabilities of these configurations, for example, why couldn't I sum up the probabilities of this site being occupied? So, I'm not sure you can factorize it that way. You cannot factorize it that way, no. Yeah. Let me answer that later. Okay, so two free parameters per TF, and right. So you can use something called dynamic programming. It's an algorithmic technique that will do this summing over an exponential number of configurations in time linear in the length of the sequence. It's something always used in bioinformatics algorithms, and it works. It's pretty fast then to do this computation. And please note that the predicted expression levels are going to be relative. That is, because we said the gene expression level is proportional to this fractional occupancy of the BDM, there's no way in the model to predict anything absolute about the expression levels. Yes. Right. Yeah. It's exactly. So there is. So there's this paper by Segal et al. Which did something very similar, except this part. This part was different. What they did was they sum over all configurations of the enhancer, and then for each configuration they count the number of occupied sites and do a logistic function, and it. You know, that seems, I don't know, a little more ad hoc than this. But in doing so, they make the computational problem much harder, and they have to do sampling and so on. It's not complete. Whereas this is, it is amenable to dynamic programming and therefore very fast. And so as I mentioned, the code is not available, so that was one of the motivations for doing this.
But also, the feature of that is because Iran has introduced thousands of free parameters by optimizing PWM, and then over, this is like last little.
Right, that's the implementation details instead of, right, yes, yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah. But that point is independent. I mean, you can do that with the framework.
Right, it is independent. I could. It's not a model thing, That's what Google was.
The difference in the model is really the readout, right? You have independent readouts.
So the other part of the implementation has to be the parameter training, of course, because you can do dynamic programming to predict expression given the parameters, but then given any set of enhancer sequences and their output expression profiles, you need to learn the parameter values such that the model output best fits the data. Standard parameter estimation question. And so the system where we tested this first had 40 to 50 CRMs that drive AP patterns, very much like the CRMs that Steve was describing and Alex was describing earlier. Pattern here is the expression vector, that's relative expression values in each of about 100 bins along the AP axis. So that's a simplistic way to represent the expression pattern. And there were 6 to 10 transcription factors that have been the key players, established key players for the system. So their motifs were given as inputs as well. So now I'll start discussing various issues. Now that I've described the basic framework, the objective, implementation, there are various issues that arise in building this and applying it to data. So the first issue I discuss is the objective function. So what does it mean for the model output to fit data? Right? What do you What do you base your parameter learning on? When are you happy that your model is explaining data? How do you quantify that? And so, you know, when you start such a thing, you would start with very standard, very popular approaches. You know, you can take sum of squared errors, which is the, you know, or the root mean square error. You can take correlation coefficients, you know, really trying to say I'm interested only in the pattern and not in the absolute difference between the predicted and real profiles. And so those were the standard, the obvious choices in the beginning. And each of them has problems. So for example, let's say in one case you have the red here is the real expression profile, the blue is the predicted expression profile. The correlation coefficient would deem both of these as equally good fits to the data. Now, are you happy with that or not? You know, you have to think about it. Similarly, this is the same real expression profile in both cases. In one case, the model predicts this, in the other case, the model predicts this. The sum of squared errors is about the same. Do you like that, or do you like this better than this? You know, you have to decide again. So there are issues with the standard ways to compare prediction to reality, which become pertinent in this case because we are interested in the pattern, but we are not. So this would say, oh, we got the pattern right, but that's also not okay because, you know, a little blip somewhere, it may not be as satisfactory to you as a more substantial height there. And I'll come to this point again later.
I'm a little bit confused because it would appear to me that, for instance, in that case, where you have the blip in the right place, it's just not high enough.
Right, correct.
I'm imagining that there is one easy knob you can turn.
Right.
Whereas in the second case, you know, where you have flanking.
Let's say you've turned the knob and you still get that. Okay? There's a knob. The problem arises because you'll have to then, because you're simultaneously trying to fit to multiple enhancers. Okay? So for one enhancer, you know, you have this situation, and the other, so the you have to deal with that. It's. Steve?
And all of the amplitudes are determined because they're comparisons with the one that gets the highest output?
The red, the height of the red here?
No, the height of the blue is dependent on the model. So you're adding your individual eigenvectors.
Right. Right. Yeah, it would be the best. Yeah, right. There's an additional knob that'll scale the relative expression predictions to be the best fit to the red.
But I think what I'm interested in, so you asked whether or not you would believe that. And the only way that I would tell whether I could believe it or not is if I had other examples of other answers that gave a much better or much worse.
Right. Correct, yes.
And then that height of that
right
is proportional to the one that gets the best height. And that one is the one that is, I don't know. I think that there's something big missing in here, and that is, like, what happens when you get a productive output from an enhancer? What happens to the big machinery? How
right, exactly, yes. So there is something
that. Is it a rheostat?
Right. Yeah. I would love to hear more about what your thoughts are. You know, when you do these blue-white stains, what do the blues really mean? How variable are they in terms of what they represent?
I have some other questions.
Yeah. Okay. Bill had.
I was just going to point out that you know, there's also an issue of what reality. So the measurements that you're presumably going to compare against, right, or something like analog staining or like whatever.
That's correct, yes.
Those aren't absolute measurements either.
Right.
Right? So, in fact, they're not absolute measurements of expression level. And actually, in the databases, sometimes they're not even absolute measurements of position or the answer about your access.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, in order to put everything together,
right.
They've done various things.
Right.
And there's lots of
different. So, but yeah, so there is a problem.
For example, if we normalize things so that RPG, the maximum expression level is 1.
Exactly.
Which is, in fact, probably what the data you're comparing against look like as well.
That's
it would seem like issues about, that like some of these issues would go away, right? So, I mean, if I have a little bump here and a big bump there, their relative height certainly means something.
Like, there's issues because when they see just the whole screen, and so then you get into such a ratio, and then you can back it
Yeah, I don't have a great answer to. I mean, I'm just trying to point out that there is a problem in the way that.
I mean, you presented it as a problem of, you know, how do I find my metric for fitting?
Right.
But in fact, in aligning data that you take as ground truth, somebody introduced a metric for how they put things about each other.
Right.
And so
right.
It's
not
all your problem, right?
Yeah.
Some of it comes with.
Yeah. Alex?
I guess my question is related to that. So, the red bar here, or measurement here, translates an essentially two-dimensional pattern, which is in fact even more two-dimensional, but let's forget about that, into a one-dimensional, right?
Right.
So is this intensity, the average intensity at that x position, average over all y positions, or what exactly?
So the data set that I originally ran the code on was from Segal et al.'s paper. So I think it was just along one axis, not even average.
Yeah,
but since then, we've So since then, what we've gone on to do is to take the average along the vertical, you know, along the DV axis at each position. That has its own problems. Right. So, but what I want to point out is that the objective function is really a matter of choice. I mean, you have to in any kind of model fitting, you have to decide what you care about, the data. You know, how do you represent the data, or how do you represent what you mean by an agreement between data and prediction? So, I just wanted to point that out. So. The implementation we used first was actually alternating between average CC and RMSE. You know, try to optimize one, get the parameters, use that as starting parameters for a second round of optimization. And but since then, we've moved on to something that we call the pattern generating potential, or PGP, as the objective function. And it's basically we engineered an objective function that we were the least unhappy about. And sort of based on those lines, that we don't care. We care about the pattern, but not just the pattern. When you're comparing multiple enhancers fits, we care about the absolute levels as well. You can't predict. The absolute levels in two different enhancers can't be 100-fold or 1,000-fold different in height. Right. So that's good news then. Then some of those problems.
You can do anything with the levels. I would just not worry about it. And it's also a question.
What you're saying is that I shouldn't be running the code at all right now. I can't leave the levels unattended. You know, you can have the model predict the gene expression, which is 1,000-fold weaker in one enhancer than the other. You know, the model is free to do that the way it's framed.
But I'm just saying that the way those enhancers were tested, and over the years they were tested on different papers.
Right.
You know, you can't compare the signal. I mean, first of all, it's a non-quantitative technique.
Right.
But also they're inserted to different locations of the genome.
Right. I understand.
His problem and Bill's problem is essentially boiling down to say, you should set the highest level spatially for one enhancer to one for all enhancers.
And then
the absolute level of the expression of this enhancer means nothing, or let's put it, not so much.
Okay.
So forget about that. Because you're spending a lot of time on this, I'm presuming that means that depending on what choice you make,
right,
you have different answers.
Right.
Because if it turns out it's all sort of monatomic in each other, so you get...
So you set to one and then care about the height predicted. That's what you're suggesting.
The relative heights across the embryo, yes. But not different heights for different enhancers.
Like spatial prediction, like prediction of spatial patterning, I think you could do, but predicting the relative levels of the, you know, different enhancers compared to each other.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also an important choice, right? Because we know that enhanced connection strength, it's just an important choice given the problem of the experiment.
Exactly.
Right.
So exactly, this is the thing. So we know that this exists biologically, but at the moment, the data in the literature, we don't have any quantitative information on cancer.
Because somewhere there's a, as you've written it, there's a parameter which corresponds to the absolute level. And since nobody measures that, you should take that out.
How would this work if you took the maybe simplest choice and only talk about binary input? So if you treat the experimental data as binary, that's what I get. Inner puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's either off or on.
That's what they're suggesting, yes. But the model is not binary. The model will be, is obviously.
No, this is not what they suggested. They suggested for each enhancer to put the maximum level to one.
Right.
But then
oh, okay. Okay. As opposed to what you...
I'm just wondering what would happen if you had just a binary... If you treated the experimental data in a binary fashion, so
uh-huh,
along the x-axis or off, and nothing...
So since Boris stepped up, can I ask a repeat question? What's on the slide after that? Okay,
thanks, so Bill. Thanks, Bill. I wanted to point out that there's an issue here. I'll be happy to talk more about this to you guys. There's more issues I want to point out. So I said, you know, I'll just skip this slide entirely. The other issue that I've already mentioned is that we want to do a simultaneous fit to all the CRMs. And that's important. You know, there's been work in the past that's fitted to one CRM or, you know, two CRMs. And, you know, it's really easy to find parameters that fit a couple of CRMs perfectly well. And that's really under constraint problem with this many parameters or any equivalent model. And you need to be very careful about that issue. And so that's why it, you know, in this case it was important that we were trying it on 40 to 50 different enhancers with different kinds of patterns. We later realized that we should also be including some sequences that don't drive any expression as to further constrain the problem, and really that has consequences on what you learn. And this point I've already made is that you need an objective function to compare output prediction to reality, which will not only tell whether one prediction is better fit than another prediction for the same CRM, but it will also be able to compare the fits from, you know, for one enhancer to the fits in the other, because you'll be adding up the quality of fit from multiple enhancers altogether. We've already discussed that. Also, in practice, at least in the current stage of affairs, there'll be some or many CRMs where we are missing key transcription factors, and the model predicts complete rubbish. While it does, it predicts very well. You know, for other CRMs, the inputs are much better characterized. The relevant players are among those 6 or 10 transcription factors that I mentioned, and so you might want, but that's a problem, because a simultaneous fit to all enhancers will try to do well on average, and that'll mess up or give you parameters that you don't really want. And so perhaps we'd like to allow the optimization to pass on some enhancers, and predict only for its favorite enhancers. But then there's a statistical issue there. You know, how do you, you know, what if it decides to predict only on one enhancer and passes on all but that one? And so you have to, there are some statistical issues there as well in evaluating the quality of fit. There's also algorithmic issues, but I won't dwell on that. These are standard computer science algorithms we've been, numerical algorithms we've been using. The public implementation uses some combination of a gradient descent and the simplex method. We also tried an evolutionary strategy. Bottom line, on real data, similar parameters came out. On realistic but simulated data, also real similar results came out. These algorithms often need good starting points, and we did a fairly exhaustive search of the parameter space, like 100,000 different parameter settings randomly chosen, and then evaluate all of them, choose the best 1,000 best starting points, and then run the algorithms with those. So there are some optimization questions that we had to address. Just as an example of what kinds of fits come out, so these are the results of training the model on the AP data. These are some of the good ones. The red is the supposedly real expression pattern, and the blues are the predicted expression patterns. And so this is what the best fit tends to look like. There are, you'll have cases like this or this where you haven't got the border quite right, cases like this where this is the hunchback anterior activator, and there are people in this group who completely, will tell us a lot about why we can't get this from the model I described. There are cases where we would miss one part of the expression pattern. These could be dynamic issues as well, because Nubbin, I think, starts off as a single gap in a band and then separates into two. Anyway, this just a visual, not of what are some of the good fits. Coming out of the model. Right. So the next step is to see if we can go beyond the basic model I described and add additional aspects to it and see and get better fits to the data. For example, the model that I described versus a model that includes short range repression, which many people in the community have demonstrated to be very important for some of these early enhancers. Now, one minor issue, one obvious issue that we face here is, yes? Short range repression is when a repressor's action is limited to a region around it. Which was not the case the way I wrote the model, which was just from anywhere it could destabilize the configuration. Threshold function on what? Right. Right. Yeah. So I'll try to add.
Nothing interacts with each other.
Right. So correct. So I'll have to change the model.
No,
no, not until not based on what I've described, exactly. So I'll describe how I changed the model to bring in this biologically or by known phenomenon of short range. Anyway, another technical issue here is that when I'm comparing one model versus another, if the models vary in the number of parameters, I have to worry about that as well, because with more parameters you're expected to do better. And so one approach is to use the same ideas but under a cross-validation scheme, which takes care of the additional parameter. All right, so mechanistic aspects. I'll describe three of them, three various mechanistic changes that we made to the model. The first one is cooperative DNA binding by pairs of transcription factors. And again, you all know about what I'm referring to here. The way we model it is that when two activator molecules are bound, there'll be, in our case, two adjacent sites. And that has to do with the implementation speed. There'll be an additional energy term representing interactions between those bound molecules, and which will further stabilize that configuration. So you can, in this manner, improve the non-linear increase in the binding strength or stability of a configuration coming from two interacting proteins bound to each other. So this is a very minor change, at the implementation level. This is very easy to handle. If you wanted such interactions to cross other sitting molecules, that'll be problematic for the implementation. It'll be you can't do dynamic programming easily. So we just did that. We added an additional parameter per transcription factor, and then we compared the resulting model's fit to the model fits from the baseline model. So for example, here's a model which is no cooperativity. The average correlation coefficient is 0.547, and you add Bicoid self-cooperativity, and it goes up at the expense of one parameter, and so you have to check with cross-validation, and there also it goes up, and these are standard deviations. It also goes up substantially when we included Knuth's self-cooperativity, and it did not go up that much with the other and when introducing self-cooperativity for the other transcription factors. This is the kind of difference that comes out of a model with cooperativity. That's the green one, and a model without cooperativity, the blue one. And as you were pointing out, things can get sharper because of that. This is the AP axis. In this case, from 20 to bin 20 to 80, not, removing the terminal parts, because at that point we were not modeling the terminal parts. We were not clear what are the relevant factors there.
So your cooperativity is self-cooperativity.
It is, no, yes. Yeah, so it doesn't. Right, so I'll be coming to that in the next slide. But this is what I refer to as DNA binding cooperativity. And so, yeah, I'm talking about self-cooperativity only, and we did try making the cooperativity value scale with, change with distance, with some predetermined distance functions, various functions. Didn't matter. Probably we don't have this, we don't have enough power here to detect such subtleties. We also tried heterotypic cooperativity. Again, nothing came out of that. But we didn't try what you were talking about, which is arbitrary heterotypic in any pair of molecules. We were trying specific pairs.
I mean, one thing that I'm reminded of are these so-called chip hotspots, where
right.
binding of one factor, they see binding of 8 or 9 or 10 other factors.
Right.
And there might be something, I don't know what that actually means.
Yeah.
It's just possible that...
It's a good idea.
The structure of these elements and having multiple binding sites for more than one transcription factor in a relatively short region of the DNA gives some property that you could estimate.
Right. Yes.
You kind of the academic you said, what you are expanding your program to non-linear just an additive function.
No, but I don't know exactly what you mean by that. So the polymerase binding. Yeah, I'll come to that. So that doesn't have to be modeled. So that's what I'm calling synergistic activation here, which is that if you have multiple bound activators simultaneously contacting the BTM or simultaneously affecting this, stabilizing the configuration, there's an automatic form of synergy that you get out of that. This is what my initial model was. This is something I'll describe in a minute. The initial model was that both of them can simultaneously do their job, both these bound activator molecules, and their effects are multiplying, which is equivalent to adding energies. This itself leads to, synergistic effects on gene expression. You could imagine changing the model to not allow that, and say that in this configuration, either this or this will be affecting. And so it'll be a linear, like alpha plus alpha, 2 alpha effect, and rather than alpha squared effect. And that gets rid of that implicit, that automatic synergy that came with the original model.
Do this for homotopy multiple sites or across all?
No, it's across all. Because this doesn't care, right? This model, this model, will just multiply the alpha terms from every factor, yeah. So then, with these two versions of the model, you can compare. For example, we set the cooperativity to be absent. And that is, DNA binding cooperativity was absent. But in one case we have no synergy, and in the other case, in one case we have this multiplicative model, and in the other we have this additive model of activator effect, and it makes a very significant difference to the model fits. And similarly, if you even include DNA binding cooperativity in the model and then compare the additive model to the multiplicative model, again, you get a big difference. So that shows that the synergistic activation does, at least in this context, play a role.
That's what you mean, increasing the synergy. I mean, here you have taken the minimal amount of synergy.
I'd love to know more about what are the, reasonable ways to do that, that I understand. So, what are those alternatives to multiplying that you would suggest I should be doing? And again, you can get the same kinds of improvements, sharper boundaries, and this is not surprising. The red is the real expression of the CRM. The green is with synergy, the blue is without synergy. And one of the important things to point out here is that you see this effect of this multiplicative model even when you have homotypic cooperativity, DNA binding cooperativity included in the model. All right, then the third aspect we implemented, mechanistic aspect, was the short-range repression that I was referring to. And so what we do is, so these are the... these are two configurations that would have appeared in the original setting, one which has this site occupied and this site not occupied here. We add an additional, remember this is a repressor site. We add an additional configuration to the model which says that when the repressor is bound, then with some probability, the region around it, and you can define its range of influence, will be inaccessible to binding, so that this site which fell within that region is no longer allowed to be bound. So that's the change we make, and the probability of this shutdown state is the effect, is the strength of the repressor in this case. So now we no longer say that the repressor can destabilize the configuration on its own. Instead, it has to work this way by rendering the nearby regions inaccessible for binding by activator molecules. That's, it's an alternative action for the repressor molecule. And this is how we implemented short-range repression. And we didn't see, and you know, we didn't get improvements to the model fits using this kind of implementation opposed to the direct interaction model. For Krupal and Hunchback, this model was as effective as the baseline model, and that's all we got. We never got an improvement, and a significant improvement in the model fits. Another issue.
Have you not tried combining those two?
No.
Combining both the direct repressor.
Right. No, we haven't done that. No. No. There'll be one more. No, it's a number of parameters also, right? I mean, each comes with a parameter, and so you could compare the short-range model with the direct interaction model because the number of parameters was the same. Another issue is missing transcription factors. I mentioned this. If you're not including an important input in your model, you know, you not only will be doing poorly, but you run the risk of incorrectly inferring mechanistic influences, which were really due to a missing, you know, Steve was pointing this out, due to a missing repressor or so, you know, that's something to worry about as well. And what we do is, in a general approach, is to fit a model, characterize what regions of the embryo do we have, you know, repression missing or activation missing, and that gives us ideas of what, you know, looking at gene expression levels of transcription factors gives us ideas of what to include, and then include it and see if it helps and so on. So that's a general approach. We added sloppy, paired, capicua, and nubbin in this way, and each of those improved the fits to the model while accounting for the additional complexity. All right. Something that we're working on now is to try to extend this to modeling entire gene loci. So not what all I've described so far is the pattern driven by specific enhancers. Ideally, we would like a program which whose parameters have been fit now can now take, you know, entire intergenic region around a gene and predict its expression, gene expression profile. And this gets into questions that have been discussed earlier about how do you model enhancer combination, you know, how do you combine the outputs of multiple enhancers? And so we're beginning to build the frameworks for that and looking out at the community for ideas for how to do those combinations. We would like to predict gene expression from the entire locus, but we don't know the CRMs anymore. We don't know the locations of the CRMs. And so, for example, given the 16 KB Eve locus, can we predict the 7 stripes? Of course, we cannot. Obviously, if you try to predict from the entire sequence as one enhancer, it won't work because it doesn't work that way. The notion of CRMs is module. You know, there is some fundamental idea to the modularity of CRMs. They don't mess up with each other that much.
So you're saying If you just apply your model to the entire sequence, you do a lot worse than saying, I know there are a couple of enhancers here, and I'm going to only run my model on these enhancers, and then sum up what they do with the expression pattern.
That's correct.
So, following that, can you try to include your model into your model some things that do not give you stress? There are some things that I guess you could get out.
For at the training stage? Yes, you do that.
And does it?
It changes the settings, parameter settings, yes. We do that. So we do it in a very crude way. We just take arbitrary pieces from the genome, you know, a bunch of them, and pretend that they will not, you know, with these transcription factors, they will not be driving, most of them will not be driving.
I would expect it doesn't help much in terms of predicting quality, or does it help?
No, no. But it changes the parameter settings. That's what, yeah. So that's what we did first then. We slide a window, predict the output of each window, combine those outputs, and add, you know, one way to combine is just add them up. And that doesn't work. And I think this, the simplest explanation I can offer is that is the notion of the levels. You know, we could never make the different stripe elements have the same absolute values. And so you can imagine if you don't have a very sharp stripe, you have a little bit of fuzz, and the heights are differing, then when you add up, you know, it, you don't get much. So this is something computer science theoreticians do all the time. When you're in trouble, redefine the problem. You know, we are not able to do this, so that we redefine the problem as we're now given the seven stripe pattern, and we're given the entire locus. Can we fit the model to, you know, with some possibly with some free parameters, so that the prediction fits the reality? So there'll be some additional free parameters, which will be weights for these windows. That's what we'll be doing. So it's the same idea again. You'll be sliding a window, predicting the output from each window, and then you have a weight. You're allowed to use a relative weighting for the different.
So the weight is a free parameter.
The weight is a free parameter. In fact, each window can have its weight, but then in a 16 KB, you'll have, I don't know, 1600 windows or 160 windows. You can't deal with that.
There's no mutual exclusivity, right? So it's not the case.
No. Right, right.
And these guys could interact with the transcription machinery, or these guys could, but they can't both at the same time.
Right. I mean, you tell me what's known about that. I mean, if you allow both to interact, you'll get, you know, that amounts to some kind of synergy, you know, like synergies from cross CRM synergies. If you don't allow them to, if you insist that only one of them can do, then they can be independent, and you can do this addition. So, I don't know the answer. I mean, if you guys have an idea, you can tell me what. If you want to model simultaneous effects, you can, you know, we can do exactly what we did with binding sites, individual activators. You know, it'll result in a synergistic effect on the gene expression. But all that is, we haven't done that yet. What we do right now is the simple. It assumes that both are not interacting in that implicit manner, and we're just using weighted sums. But again, you can't have every window contributing. So what we do, I'll describe with this example, so these blue things are the unknown enhancers for Harry. And what we do is scan the region, find a window that fits some part of the expression pattern, and keep it. then scan again, find another window that, in a weighted combination with that previous window, improves the fit. You know, explain some more of the expression pattern, and keep doing this. Each time when we add a window, a free parameter gets used up, and we keep doing this until we are happy by some metric of being measure of being happy. And so what happens at the end is that we find 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different windows that were included in the model. So seven parameters were used, seven different weights. Which together, so the outputs of these windows in a weighted combination produce the seven strength.
Super cool. But how do you select, if you can say a few more words about scanning and selecting? So, because you have this model, and there is a whole procedure that you need to fit once you are given the window.
We repeat that whole procedure.
Huh?
We repeat that whole procedure every time.
For all of them.
So you
right.
Fit different parameters to different windows.
What?
So you may fit different parameters.
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely, yes. I mean, that was the point earlier. You need different weights. Oh, no, not different parameters. No.
But so then when do you fit the parameters?
This is very much work in progress. I won't have a good answer for you. The answer is that we take a model fit from all CRMs except these guys, like other AP CRMs.
Favorite parameter setting from some other fitting you've done,
right.
And you fix that for this.
We actually allow those to vary a little bit around that. At the moment, this is the situation. We would ideally like to just keep those fixed parameters. It turns out, we'd ideally like not to change those parameters, but they are changing with. It's really, you're not retraining everything. You're insisting on a small region around that favored parameter setting. But the real free parameters are the window weights. So you do, incidentally, including runt here actually helps separate stripes 3 and 4. That's what my student just emailed me yesterday. So another example where some transcription factor missing would not let you have a good fit. This is what we got for Eve. So the red is the prediction, obviously. And we completely miss Eve stripe 1. And this is a little off, but that's what it looks like. And we discover 1, 2. That was done with these 4 windows being used up. That's the windows can be, I don't know. Let's say we found this window first. We try a whole bunch of windows of varying sizes at every place. Okay, find one. What? No, we don't have a fixed window size, and we don't insist on non-overlapping windows either. No. So remember that I'm running the model on this piece separately, and then separately running on this one, and then adding up. So yes,
So then to go back to the statement that if you just take the whole region, it doesn't work.
Right.
Isn't really the only thing that you need to make it work is to say there are some masks where there are certain areas that are not allowed to contribute for whatever reason.
Right.
And whatever is left.
Right. So you're asking whether once I identified these windows, would just taking this amount of sequence and this as one sequence, would it be enough to, right? I don't know the answer. We're still doing that.
Even in modeling, instead of sliding all these windows and then put one window down, first make a prediction from the entire thing.
Uh-huh.
And then give yourself one knob that allows you to locally sort of turn off the stuff that's coming from there.
Okay.
I think it's
worth trying. Yes, Alex.
No, it's a local knob.
How do you use this experimental setup for the goal for over 2 years?
Right. We have to think about that. You know, we have to think about what would be a suitable control. You know, that we haven't thought about this. Exactly. That's the point. That would be the control if we could.
You would do that by definition, right? Because you're optimizing towards the fit.
No. We are not. So as I said, the underlying the model parameters are more or less fixed. You know, ideally they have to be completely fixed. It's just these window weights. You think that given any pattern with the freedom to find these windows and window weights, we can.
This is a bet. We can bet for one.
With the.
But I think that given an arbitrary pattern and the 16 GB locus of which you can pick arbitrary windows with arbitrary weights, you can fit any pattern.
With the okay, that's a fair bet. We can. I don't. I know.
At least you can get from the combinations of types. So if you imagine you give it a pattern on the accused type, so you give any gene from the
right
from this cascade of generating AP.
It's not obvious. Yeah, it's not obvious.
No, it's not obvious to do because that requires that you can find in this region some windows that give you expression in the right places.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't, like, for example, use the global pattern, but you could at least definitely do any of the individual stripes, right?
In principle, there are actually.
No, because remember that the underlying models were trained on known AP enhancers, right? They were trained not to do.
I mean, you could take the locus, find stripe 2, and set all the other windows to 0. So you would have a perfect fit for a pattern that has nothing to do with the E pattern. I mean, that is a subpart of the E pattern, but it's not the E pattern.
Right.
By definition.
Yes, yes.
You could by just putting window weight to 0.
But that's not a. I mean, that's not a an ideal control. It's.
You could probably not deny me there. You could probably not get an EP pattern, right? Because this has never been modeled by the way you predict.
Right.
But any AP.
Okay, so we have to see. I know I completely understand and respect your point, but we don't know the answer. We'll find out.
Maybe
so.
Yeah,
I'll two more slides or three more slides.
Hold on some questions just to let us finish off the
thing. So this is with Eve, with Runt. This stripe, this is the fourth stripe is missing. With Giant, the I think the red is the prediction. Three, and it also turns out that the windows that were found, not surprisingly, were correct windows. I think one other thing that we have to do here is my student is probably stopping too early, so I would imagine that there are other windows, uncharacterized CRMs, which also have the same pattern and should be added. We've also been working on the effect of DNA accessibility. You know, and again, this is very much in progress. Just use accessibility data as a filter, and that's led to an improvement overall in the PGP, a significant improvement. I have to skip the entire evolution part and stuff here. Thank you.
God's bioinformatics gives it, right?
No, but so Mike Brodsky.
I say, I don't believe any of this stuff. However, I do believe that there are N binding sites for this transcription factor in this cancer.
Right.
But let's assume that they each have binding energy E. One per, right?
Right.
Now, since a motif has 20 plus parameters, I can do that 20 times without having a more complicated model, right?
Right.
And yes, I'm going to miss some details of probably, you know, the binding to this little piece and that little piece are different from each other. But I'm not insisting that I know the relationship between sequence and binding, which in truth is not that well tested. It's pretty well tested, but it's only approximate. So if I did that, would I do any better? Or is the problem really somewhere else?
Right. So I can't give you the answer because I haven't implemented the model you were talking about. I assume you would still allow, want to allow for. Okay, you won't allow for any.
I gave you the simplest version because I was trying to.
So you would say your parameter would be how many sites are there.
Right.
So then, yeah, it's a very, you know, very, very good question. Whether, you know, you can capture whether. So you're saying that you know, there's no, it doesn't matter whether there's five sites or five weaker sites or three stronger sites.
No, it might, right?
But if it does, then you need to understand, you need to make a distinction.
You have a number of sites and you have a binding energy.
What I don't understand is, because now you're no longer taking any sequence.
Exactly.
So what are you predicting from there? I mean, then why do we still have a sequence?
Well, because, well, I mean, it's not clear to me that
that's true.
Part works that well, right? I mean,
it's a matter, so you have to compare.
Suppose, for example, that I told you, well, I have an answer. Somebody has claimed to identify N binding sites for this transition.
I can take that as given.
Let's suppose you take that as given.
Okay.
And you say, but I don't know their energy.
But it's a different question altogether, because in this case, when we are trying to build tools to fit 50 or 100 enhancers together, I don't think how we can assume we know for each of them how many sites are there. No?
Yeah.
And by the way, the motifs were not informatics based motifs. They were taken from my collaborators Brodsky and Wolf, who used this bacterial one hybrid. The implementation can't do that, and that would mean so many more. I mean, each motif would be 30 parameters then. I mean, that gets into big statistical problems. Another question? All right, thanks very much.